Vision of the ram and the goat. So this picture is actually 3 years ago. Camille's brother lives on a, he has a farm, and it's just farm land, but actually their son has goats. So this is one of his billy goats. And to me, it's one of the weirdest goats I've ever seen, especially winking at you with the one curly horn. It was kind of strange looking to me. So anyways, that's my picture today, it's a goat. So in case you've never seen a goat, and we have never, everybody's seen goats, right? Yeah. Well, you went to NAG school, so you've seen goats. You've probably seen inside a goat, even. Sheep. Oh, wow. So, yeah, they got all that kind of stuff. So, anyways, it's goats. We keep thinking we'll get goats, because I know they'll eat palmetto and everything. But since we have bobcats and coyotes, I figure the cycle of life might not be the funnest thing to watch. So, anyways, we don't have goats. So, anyways, we're in chapter 8. And chapter 8 symbolically portrays the conquest of the Near East by the Greeks in the 4th century B.C. So, in case you have to leave early or you really think you'd rather go to Paul's class or the Spanish class, you've pretty much got today's lesson. So, anyhow, when do you think the chapter is written? If it's going to describe the conquest of the Near East by the Greeks in the 4th century B.C., when do you think this was written? Way before then is the absolutely correct answer. It's way before then. And here's, if you don't like history, again, this is not the class today either. So this is what we're going to look at today. In 605 BC, and these are all probably, I would say, approximate, but these are what I got from notes and stuff. 605 BC, Daniel is taken from Jerusalem to Babylon. By 562, that's the death of Nebuchadnezzar. 556, Nabonidus came to power, and Belshazzar becomes his co-regent. 539, Babylon fell to Cyrus the Persian. We've talked about all those events in the first 10 lessons up to this point. And in 334, Alexander the Great led an army across the Dardanelles into Persian territory. And that's really something that'll be in today's lesson. So you can see there about a 200-year gap. What Daniel's vision is will be something that happens 200 years later. Anybody know what the Dardanelles is? No? It's the gap in Turkey, and it's where Asia and Europe basically meet. It's a little gap, and Turkey's on both sides of that gap. So if you ever look at a map, it kind of closes in there. I think it's the Caspian Sea. I might be wrong on that. I don't know. I don't know my geography that well, but you will see that little neck down area, and it's called the Dardanelles. The significance of what Daniel describes, not just the details that are described, but rather that God, through Daniel, revealed events that would happen 200 years in the future. At the time of this vision, the Medo-Persian Empire was in the early stages of establishing itself. The Greek Empire was non-existent. And that's probably something to keep in mind as we go through there. Do idols portray the future like this in detail? Would an idol be able to predict some events that will happen in 200 years and portray them in detail that's understandable, detail that's, you think they could do that? That's something that's going to separate God from idols. If you went to a palm reader, the one down here in Bellwood, is that where that, there's a palm reader down Frontenac, Bellwood, somewhere down there. If you went to see that palm reader, would they be able to predict 200 years in the future?
Would.
Yeah, if you ask them, you pay them enough, right? It's going to cost extra. And you're not even going to be around in 200 years, and they're not going to be. It's like, you know, big deal, right? There's no guarantees on it. Could they even portray it in detail? Something 2 weeks from now, could they portray it in enough detail that you would say that's absolutely right? Have we ever been to one of these kind of places? Psychics? Palm readers? Somebody that reads bones of chickens? None of that stuff? I've never been. I know people that used to go to Casadega, and that's a town full of psychics and stuff, and they would go just to get in their futures read. And it was always, they would find love or they would not find true love, and it'd be some kind of mysterious description that you make up your own story from there. But nothing that would really give details. And that's kind of how that stuff goes. Horoscopes, right? You can read the horoscope still today. Anybody read a horoscope? Not in years. Not since we stopped getting the newspapers, right? That was always one of the things. I'd read the newspaper and it's like, oh, there's a horoscope. Let's read that and see what kind of potential mischief I can get into. But no, I haven't. Once in a while, I come across one. It's always fun to read them. I wouldn't put my life on it, but I know people who do or used to. Probably, what, the 70s, that was probably the most popular time for that kind of stuff. So, 60s. It's kind of... Yeah, astrology. Oh, he was, wasn't he? I forgot Reagan was into that. That kind of stuff, and there's still. It's kind of hard to separate them at one point, I think. So, yeah. So it's still there. Anyways, you won't really get that many details, in case you didn't know. God's message is clear. He rules over the nations of the earth, and that's what we're going to look at today. So we'll get right into the text. Daniel 8, verse 1, and we're going to go up through about 22, a little bit into 23. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. So when does Daniel say this vision occurred? Third year of Belshazzar. Yeah, there you go. Okay, we looked at Belshazzar's feast in chapter 5. That lesson had the handwriting on the wall. He had the feast, the handwriting on the wall, and what happened with that? It was the end of his reign. The handwriting on the wall, he died that day. Daniel read it, interpreted the handwriting, read it, interpreted it. Belshazzar died that same night. So this vision happened while Belshazzar is still alive. Okay, so early in his reign. Yeah, I don't know how long Belshazzar was in power. Didn't even look. Was it really? Well, I back up here. I got the numbers right there. Nebuchadnezzar died in 562. Nabonidus, Belshazzar come to power in 556. Yeah, that makes sense because looks like 17 years really before Babylon falls to Cyrus. That's when it happens, right? So 17 years in. So yeah, 3 years in out of a 17-year reign or thereabouts. Because some of that stuff is... Did you know Rembrandt did a painting of Belshazzar's feast? I didn't know it. It's clearly Rembrandt. And the details in that stuff, when you figure those guys did paints and they mixed their own paints, they didn't go down to Hobby Lobby and say, hey, you got a deep ochre, you got a midnight blue. They didn't do that kind of stuff. And they made and mixed their own paints. The thing is actually very stunning in detail. You know, the amount of work that goes into that is crazy. I couldn't hope to have a photograph as good as what he's got there, to be honest. But it's cool. So anyways, for your future viewing, Rembrandt has Belshazzar's feast. Daniel 8:2, and I saw in a vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in a vision, I was at the Ulai Canal. In Daniel's vision, where was he? Susa. Or Shushan is another way it's written in some Bibles. Shushan. I don't know how it is. Anyways, that's where he was at. Not necessarily that he was there, although I guess there's some people that say that he was actually there. He may have been sent by Belshazzar on a business trip, essentially, but possibly just in the dream, and it doesn't really matter. It won't affect it. I stole some maps off the internet. I try to put where I stole them from, but they don't tell me where they stole them from. So anyways, I didn't spend my time tracking all that stuff down. They seem to be about everywhere. Accuracy of these maps, rate it, who knows? So anyways, I figure you need a map, because most of us don't have good 4th century BC knowledge of geography. So the blue area, the baby blue area, is the Babylonian Empire. And I kind of blew that up. I guess I didn't really blow it out much. But anyways, between the Persian Gulf over to the Mediterranean, on the left side, that would include what we consider Israel or Canaan. You can see Jerusalem over there. You can see Syria. That'd be Lebanon. On the right side, you can see Babylon, where the water, where the rivers come together. Elam is just northwest of the Persian Gulf right there. So that would be where Susa is, and where it, relative to the Babylonian Empire. You can see the Dardanelles right there in the bottom right corner. Is that right? Yeah, right there in the bottom right corner. No, that's not it. Duh, sorry, top left. You're right. That is Dardanelles up there in the top left. Sorry, Chuck. You're... Yeah. Hey, I think this thing's got a laser pointer, doesn't it? Does it have a laser pointer? There it is. Right there is the Dardanelles, that little gap right there. So I guess that's the Mediterranean. This is Greece. It opens up, and I don't know what that is. I guess it's not the Caspian Sea. Black Sea, Adriatic Sea. It could be Black Sea because Russia kind of starts. Okay, Black Sea. I either need to pay more attention to the news or... More Jeopardy, there you go. What is Dardanelles? What is the Black Sea? So anyways, so you got Susa here. This is Israel. There's Babylon. So that's where he's at, is Susa in the dream. I got several other maps. Like I said, I thought the same thing, but that would be in Israel, right? That would be over here. But that's not in Israel. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's the Summer Palace. Oh, okay. That could be. It could be. But I think, isn't there one? Didn't David go to one? A similar place? I don't know. I'm conjecturing here and show my ignorance, to be honest. Daniel 8:3, I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high. But one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. So what did Daniel see? I got to have a few questions in here, because at one point it stops asking questions. There's just no way to ask questions. He saw a ram, right? Okay. And he's got a pretty good description of this ram. Apparently a different kind of ram than we normally see. Very different. Okay. So he's got two horns. One says both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. Okay, so he's got tall and really tall horns. And the short one came up last. I don't know, I've not been around many goats like and rams and stuff, but like I said, but the higher one came up last, sorry, right. But you would expect that they started at the same time, right? Goats and sheep I've seen in petting zoos have two horns, not one. So somehow something's happened here. And the taller one, maybe they were the same height and then that one grew. Anyways, I guess that really, it's really symbolic. Anyways, horns on an animal are symbols in their power and their virility. In Psalms 18:2, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge, my shield and the horn of my salvation, my stronghold. Even God is described as a horn, the horn of salvation. Happens here and also happens in 2 Samuel, but that symbolism is used for power. The Medes were represented by the first horn, and their empire east of Babylon had existed for centuries. Like I said, I kind of run out of questions at this point, because unless somebody knows more about this than I do, and they should have taught the class. So anyways, so the first horn represents the Medes. The green area is the Median Empire. It's been around for centuries, sometimes bigger, sometimes smaller. But you can kind of see it's basically west. It goes a little bit north too, but it goes west of where east. I don't know why I get that confused with that. I don't get it confused in America. Anyways. That's the Median Empire. And it's like I said, it's been around forever. Not forever, but it's been around for centuries. and that represents the first horn. The Persians are represented by the second horn. In 8:4, I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him, and there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased and became great. Around 540 BC, a middle-aged king named Cyrus came to the throne of Persia. Persia was a small realm that paid tribute to the Medes. Within 10 years, Cyrus had made all the Medes and Persians subject to himself. So in a very short time, he started one empire. He enveloped a bigger, older empire. And within 20 years, Cyrus conquered Babylon and was master of the eastern world. And 200 years after Daniel's vision, the Medo-Persian Empire extended from India to Ethiopia to Greece. And there is a picture that I borrowed off the internet on that. And you can see the Medo-Persian Empire, like I said, it goes clear down into Africa, it goes into Egypt, it goes into parts of Greece. It's more than what the Medes ever had. It goes clear over into India. So this is something that the Persians were able to do. And in a short time, 20 years, did I say 20 years? Yeah, 20 years he was able to conquer Babylon and master the Eastern world. That's impressive. That's a very short time to be able to do that kind of thing in reality. So the Greeks were a little threat to the Persians. They were a motley assortment of independent cities who constantly warred and squabbled with one another. I got that from the notes. It's not my opinion, it's theirs. And back here, you can see Greece up here in the upper left. It starts to go into that, but they weren't really a threat. They weren't an empire yet. They were just cities, just a civilization. 8:5. Yeah. Okay. They tried a couple times, but weren't successful. It happens later. Okay. Eventually, we'll see that the Greeks are stronger, and they'll overcome all that. 8:5, as I was considering, behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground, and that goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. I guess actually back on 8:4, it talked about the charging westward, northward, and southward. Like I said, what was the Median Empire, it becomes part of the Persian Medio-Persian, and it grows in all its directions, just as it says in a prophecy. So in the mid-4th century B.C., Philip established himself in Macedonia, to the north of the Grecian peninsula. I'll back up. Macedonia is like this area right here. So, came into great wealth. He hired mercenaries. He and his generals developed battle tactics that no one in Greece could withstand. So Philip becomes stronger in Greece. He came to the ram, Daniel 8:6. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal, and he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him close to the ram. He was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled on him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. When Philip was assassinated in 336 B.C., his son, 20-year-old Alexander, inherited his role. Within 2 years, Alexander was in Asia. Within 10 years, the Greeks had established their great empire. The Greek empire, led by Alexander the Great, is represented by the male goat, which just conquered the ram. The Greek empire is purple. So the Greek empire gets bigger. It goes, and just, you know, like that, 10 years? Is what I said? In 10 years, the Greeks, who had been nothing, conquered the Medo-Persian Empire, which was the greatest. So that's what this symbolism starts representing. And the one horn is Alexander. Yeah. And the goat in 8:8, then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And instead of it, there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. That's right. Alexander the Great died in 323 BC at age 32. He's probably poisoned. How was his death symbolized in Daniel's vision? But Alexander the Great is, and his kingdom. But what happens here that symbolizes Alexander the Great's death? The horn breaks. Okay, what happens to the horn when it breaks? four other horns come up. His death was so sudden that reports were denied when they reached Greece. I got that out of Wikipedia, source of all knowledge. So anyways, Alexander had no obvious or legitimate heir. His son was born after his death. His empire came to be divided among his generals, the Diadochi. Now, if I said that wrong, it's because I don't speak Greek. The successors, as they're known. And that basically went into four parts. Ptolemaic Egypt, Seleucid Mesopotamia, Central Asia, Attalid Anatolia, and Antigonid Macedon. I'm not even going to try to pronounce this right. Anyways, this map that I borrowed off the internet, historysifter.net, shows the four, as Alexander's empire is broken into four, you can see the areas that those four guys took over. And then Daniel 8:9, out of one of them came a little horn, which grew exceedingly great towards the south, towards the east, and toward the glorious land. So the one horn on the goat breaks off and four new ones grow. And out of one of those horns is even another horn. Ptolemy established himself in Egypt. The general of Ptolemy, Seleucus, eventually became king of Syria. For most of the 400 years of the intertestamental period between Malachi and John the Baptist, Ptolemy's family ruled in Canaan. But in the 2nd century BC, the Seleucids gained the upper hand. The new little horn that grew out of one of the four horns represents the Seleucids. Does anybody know where we can read about this Seleucid battle taking over? Is that then? Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It does, doesn't it? I forgot about that. It's a. Go ahead. Yeah. 1 and 2 Maccabees is when they throw that power off. And it's not in our Bible. It is, if you have a Catholic Bible, it's in the Apocrypha. That's it. So you can find that online if you want to. It's a historic account, but we don't consider it a divinely inspired account. So, anywho, Daniel 8, 10, and 11. It grew great even to the host of heaven, and some of the hosts and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And the regular burnt offering was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary was overthrown. As the Seleucids ruled Canaan, a king named Antiochus IV came to power. He called himself Epiphanes, the manifestation of God. In 167 BC, Antiochus marched into Jerusalem and determined to stamp out Judaism. Among other things, Antiochus outlawed the offering of sacrifices in the temple. Daniel 8:12, and a host will be given over it together with a regular burnt offering because of transgression, and it will throw truth to the ground and it will act and prosper. He set up a Greek idol and required the Jews to sacrifice it. These are all historical things. I told you there's not much excitement in this whole thing other than the fact that it lines up with history pretty neat. Daniel 8:13-14, and I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, "For how long is division concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over of the sanctuary and hosts to be trampled underfoot?" And he said to me, "For 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state." His offenses against the Jews eventually led to the Maccabean revolt, like Chuck talked about. The Jews ruled an autonomous state in Canaan until the Roman conquest in 63 BC. When I was at the School of Preaching over in Lakeland, we looked at some of this with the end times, I guess the short and long prophecies. And I remember looking at some of this, and to be honest, I have no idea other than the fact that we looked at it. I know the 2,300 days is 7.5 years. Is that right? Yeah, 7 years. I think it's 7 years, basically. It's 7 years. And I know seven means all or till completeness. Seven is complete. So anyways. And some of this stuff, like I said, it's short and long. So they kind of there's some that look at it as premonition of the end times. Daniel 8:15-16, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it, and behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, "Gabriel, make this man understand the vision." So who is Gabriel? Archangel. Archangel, yeah. He's mentioned four times in the whole Bible by name, twice in the Old Testament, once here, once in Daniel 9:21. In the New Testament, he's mentioned in Luke 1. It's not 1:1, it's 1:19, I think, and 1:26. The only times he's called by name. Daniel 8:17, so he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. So what does Gabriel say this vision is? It's of the time of the end. Time of end of what? May I ask that question? Yeah. End of what? End of explaining it? Yeah. He'll end up, like you say, Daniel 8:18-19, when he had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand up. He said, behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation, for it refers to the appointed time of the end. 20, as for the ram that you saw on the two horns, these are the kings of Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his nation, but not with his power. So all the history that we just looked at, Gabriel explains to Daniel. He explains it a lot quicker than I did. Not a whole lot quicker, because just how it rolls. But anyways. But Gabriel explains this to Daniel. This stuff's going to happen in the next 200 years. He's mentioning empires that don't even exist. He's mentioning things, like I said, during the centuries that followed Daniel, the Jewish people would complete their mission, and through them, God would raise a Savior. So when he talks about the end, it's really the end of Jewish kingdom. It's the end of the Jewish mission. It's really what the end of it is. Gabriel explained to Daniel that his vision portrayed the rise of kingdoms about which he knew nothing. Above all, it described the turmoil that would be set to the Jews in their latter days. The time of the end, Daniel 8:17, mentioned by Gabriel, likely refers to the latter time of their kingdom. And that's really where we kind of end it, in 8:23. At the later end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face, one who understands riddles, shall arise. After Jewish kingdoms ended, after the Romans asserted dominance in Canaan, Israel would have completed its mission. The covenant between God and Israel would come to a close with the rising of a new king, the offspring of David, build an everlasting kingdom. Christ would sit on his throne. God would make a new covenant with a new people to confess Jesus to be Christ. So this is really what it is. You know, Daniel came in to see the Babylonian captivity. He saw everybody leave the promised land. He would see as they start flowing back. I think he dies shortly after that, is one of my understandings. So he'll see that. But he gets open, his vision is opened to what Israel's role is from there on. And how it'll come out that there'll be a new king. That's it. That's all I got. And I'll be honest, I couldn't figure out anything to pull out of this other than the fact that God's in control. Yes.
And it's going to be forever. But understand, there's going to be these kingdoms that come. It's just talked for the third time about those successions of the same kingdoms.
Same kingdoms.
It said it in the statute. It said it when I talked last week and talked about it this week. The same succession of the kingdoms.
Yep. There will be kingdoms, but there will be one final kingdom, and that's the church. That's with Christ as the king, the church is the final kingdom. Yes.
It's pointing to the establishing. So you can't say, well, it's kind of talking about times now and like that. There's some people who take and say, we can put it in these times. You can't. The whole point of Daniel is the point to the coming of the everlasting kingdom.
Yes.
And it's contrasting temporal kingdoms to the everlasting kingdom.
It does. It contrasts it and it shows how readily they fall. The Medes are big. The Persians very quickly become bigger than the Medes. And then very quickly the Greeks become more powerful than them. land who, what they would, what is the promised land? That promised land fell under, you know, it fell under Babylonian captivity. Well, Assyrian captivity before that. Babylonian captivity. Medo-Persian captivity. Greek captivity. Roman captivity. And it ends. Christ comes, establishes a new kingdom. They stay there, but not long. Rome came in there and destroyed Jerusalem in 70, 71. Yeah. They destroy it. Israel itself ceases to exist from then till 1948. It ceases to exist. We've established Israel in 1948 for Jews who were persecuted by the Nazis. It's a great home for them. You know, like I say, it's back on the same property. The Israel today is not the Israel back then. Right, there's no temple, no daily sacrifices, no bloodline of priests. There's a lot of that's disappeared. Are there still Jews today? There are. But their mission, like I say, leading up to the Christ, that's been fulfilled. That kingdom of Israel is no longer. The kingdom, God's always been a king. He's a king today, and he always will be a king. Today his kingdom is the church. You know, I never finish early in here. I think I've finished early in here once or twice. But that's about it. And I accept that's, I opened up both sets of notes. I looked online. Unless you want to discuss the politics of, there's really nothing there other than sin. This is, you know, they open up the scrolls. This is the plan. Let me show you the big plan, Daniel. Your time will come to an end, but this is the big plan. And that's it. Yeah, it's all true. Yeah, the prediction is 200 years earlier. You know, if somebody had gone to the King of England 250 years ago and said, this is what's going to happen, they're going to, you know, people will move to a new land and they're going to establish freedom and we're going to beat you in a war, but then they're going to become friends with you later, he would have thought they're crazy, you know.
The sun never set on the
English Empire. Yeah, at that time.
200 years, 200 years in the future, you're going to be basically almost back to your island.
Yeah. Right, yeah. They very, very little compared to what they were. Like I said, it went everywhere. It was what's now United States. It was parts of South America. It was islands. It was Australia. It was India. It never set on them. And now like that with this Brexit thing, even their role with the European Union is ceasing. So back to the island in a short time. Susan?
And if you had told the Jews that were suffering in Germany in World War II, okay, here's what's going to happen to them. Here's what's going to happen to Germany. They're not going to be strong like this. It is somewhat of a comfort to those people who were slaves. And the more often you hear it, the more you're like, okay, it may affect me, but my kids, you know, it's going to, there's a future and it's going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
All these things and that, a lot of people go, oh, there's something over this again. But the people certainly needed to hear that.
They needed to hear it in a lot of different ways to make it valid. You hear it once, you know, we're all that way. You hear it once, maybe that's true, maybe it's not. You hear it some different ways, you start putting pieces together, it starts getting validity. You know, none of these people will live to see, the people this, well, obviously talking to Daniel, he'll never live to see this come true. Some of the people that, like I say, it got passed down to somebody. You know, as they go back, it got passed through those empires and was maintained somewhere, somehow.
All the prophecies about the kingdoms, I believe, were made
I believe you're right. Yeah, Jeremiah and Isaiah and all that kind of stuff, all.
But in Daniel, if you look at the kingdom of prophecy, they're all done during the Babylonian reign. That's what's
happening. Oh, you mean? Well, this one was, because Belshazzar's.
Belshazzar's Babylonian.
Yeah, you're right, he was, wasn't he? Yeah, he was Babylonian. Huh. No, that's cool. Well, once they. Yeah. He knew about the 70 years. They already knew about that, and they were looking for the end of that. But they would. What's after that? You know, there's a period where basically you don't see much of the Jews as they go back and they try to reestablish walls and reestablish a temple. They struggle big time. It's like, well, I sent you there, and for 20 years you didn't even move the old rocks around. It's like, oh, what am I going to do? And they did. They struggled. And they kind of, my understanding is there's about a 200-year period where they basically just kind of just disappear. And by the time we see Jesus, Judaism split into four major sects at that time. It's not even the Judaism of prior to the captivity. It's taken its own flavor.
Yeah, two dominant ones and two more. Very restrictive, but very small.
Yeah. So. All right, anything else? Yeah, you can hit that button.